Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
My sound is really loud.
Is it?
Yeah.
Sound great to me.
It sounds really loud, just like at home, huh?
Yeah, a little bit of an echo.
You don't even have to say
echo,
what. All right. So you can always find everything about us on our webpage at wethepeopleradio.us and .net and .org and all that. Just not .com.
No, they took .com away.
I couldn't, and they're wasting it. They're not even using it. Losers.
Yeah.
So sponsor this hour.
Team Power.
Comes to you from Bill.
That's right.
Hit it, Bill.
Yeah, Team Power, local John Deere Kubota dealer. If you're looking for a great deal on a tractor, stop by and see them out there on Twin View Boulevard, and they can make you a good deal on a John Deere Kubota tractor. Also, right now, they're running their winter service special, so if you've got a tractor of pretty much any make and you need it serviced, checked out for the season.
And don't wait till it's the day you want to mow your grass.
Yeah, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, because you guys do a lot of mowers.
Oh, we do a ton of mowers. We'll have...
Because they're the mower guys.
Yeah, busy time of the year, you'll see 30, 40 mowers out there getting worked on. So yeah, right now is a great time. Not a huge wait. Bring it in. They'll get fixed up for you and have it running like a new one. So that's Team Power at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, out there next to Phil's Propeller. And you can give them a call at 226-9226. Team Power.
Monday through Friday, 8 to 5.
There you go.
Hey, and if you want a little pedal tractor, like if you know somebody who has a kid who's really into tractors, they have these two really cute, well, actually you have three of them, Kubota pedal tractors, like the kind we used to mess around with when we were kids. One's metal.
Yeah, one's the cast metal, and the other
so
one's
for like the tough kid.
And yeah, yeah.
For
and
the
that
kid
one,
wants...
you'll never wear that one
no.
out. Chain drive, I mean, that thing you can go out and...
But for
the kid
who wants to do more stuff, it's got a loader and a trailer. And
it's anyway, a cute little rig.
Pretty fun.
Yeah, stop by.
Those
are guests today.
That is all. Those are all the announcements I can think of. Except that our archives are free of charge. And actually, I don't usually point that out because I thought everybody's were. But apparently, a lot of people now are putting their information on the web with their archives from podcasts and whatnot, and they charge to listen. You can always listen to our stuff free, and it has the commercials pulled out. So we celebrate capitalism during the show, and then we take out the capitalism so you can listen to it in a shorter time frame. But those archives date all the way back to 2010. Lots of topics. You will have no shortage of things to listen to. And a web page is created for each program. So stuff we talk about, we add all the links on there. And,
Tell a friend. Tell a friend.
Kind of a full information sort of deal.
Yeah, share the information with somebody. Just give them that website and have them log on.
All righty. So our guest today is Peter Friedman. We spoke with him for an hour last week. And I don't know. I guess I don't know if it was on his bio. I'm going to say it wasn't. I'm going to blame him. Are you in there, Peter?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. Just wanted to know you, make sure you knew I was blaming you. I didn't know you did stuff with the FBI back in the day. So since the FBI is so much in the, thick of it these days, you said, hey, let's talk about the FBI the first hour. It's like, okay. So we don't know anything, but I did find some fun music that involves like spying in the FBI. So that's my contribution today.
Yeah, we kind of wonder, with the FBI in the news so much lately, was it that way when you were involved? It seems very politicized.
Well, no, actually, it wasn't politicized. It was just incompetent. That's kind of what FBI stands for me. Famous but incompetent.
Yeah.
Oh,
boy, it sure looks that way nowadays. I mean, a lot of folks are saying, hey, there's, the rank and file are good, hardworking people, and I'm sure a lot of them are. But, gosh, there's just a lot of bad stuff we've been hearing about, and that is the rank and file. So tell us what's going on there.
Well, what did Lord Acton say? Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Yep.
And one of the... stories that I have, I did an undercover op that I was the technical advisor for back in 1990 to 1993, and I also worked as the technical advisor to Senator Cohn's two subcommittees back in 94 on counterfeit and bogus parts in the airline industry. found 39% of the ones that the FAA was using to maintain their own aircraft back there in Oklahoma City were defective.
And then
this is something else we can talk about maybe the next time, but the committee report, it was a Senate hearing, again, with Senator Cohn in April of 96 on whether or not FAA inspectors were properly trained, targeted, and supervised, which is, they're both on the Internet. It makes very interesting reading, and you'll probably never fly commercial again. But,
we talked to a pilot one time in an airport, and that scared us enough.
Yeah, well, all our flights were late. We got a little extra info.
My own airplane, and I've been a flight instructor, I think you could see from my bio, since 1977. But FBI, so I was in the contracting business, manufacturing parts since 1965, mainly for the military. And you know, you get these government contracts, you bid against other people, most of whom are not terribly honest, cut corners and stuff like that, which wound up being the subject of this investigation. So finally, in 1989, there was a bogus bolt scandal involving the Bradley tank that was being manufactured in San Jose, California by FMC Corporation, which stands for Food Machinery Corporation. There was a 2020 expose in late 89 about the bolts that were not produced correctly by this company in Texas called Aircom. They had gone to Taiwan. They had bought them in Taiwan, and they were the wrong material and everything. And so I got contacted at that time by 2020, and met Brian Ross of the current, yeah, anyway.
He didn't touch you, did he?
Yeah, anyway, that's a whole other story. And they said, you know, you want to tell us all about this problem, because what was happening was the heads of the bolts on the tanks were blowing off at night after they had been torqued down and tightened, and people thought it was gunfire. So obviously the cops were out there, the cops notified DOD and the Army, and they investigated and they found that these bolts were actually counterfeit bolts and wrong material and everything. They went after this company. So during the course of this, I had mentioned to several of the investigators, I said, well, this is nothing new. You know, this goes on all the time. Oh, really? Well, tell us more. So I did, and then in 1990, I came from Los Angeles up to the Bay Area because there were a couple of investigators for DOD down in L.A. who were, let's say, making evidence disappear. Mm-hmm. And so I told them, look, I'll be happy to help you. I said, but you're going to have to, you know, put me with, you know, somebody who's honest. And they actually found somebody. It was very interesting. Because the government, the Department of Defense Inspector General's Office had just created, just months before, the Defense Criminal Investigative Service, DCIS. So I met with DCIS, this agent, and an FBI agent out of San Francisco with the assistant U.S. attorney over there, and laid all this stuff out for him and told him exactly what I thought a sting operation should be and how to go about doing it, because by that time I'd already been in the business for, I don't know, 30 years or so. So they decided that they were going to put a sting operation together, and it was called Operation Pro Fraud. And what we did was we rented an office over in San Leandro, right next to Otis Spunkmeyer cookies, so we got to have all the cookies we wanted.
That's the upside of the investigation. Hold that thought, Peter. We have to celebrate capitalism here for 2 minutes, and we will come right back. Our guest today is Peter Friedman. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
We'll be right back. get you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about it?
But was it Brian Ross?
Yeah, but we don't need cameras in our house, do we? Gosh, I hope not.
You know, that was a fun song to listen to last night. I'm like, oh, that'll be fun tomorrow. It was. So that's you, Peter.
Okay, I'll cut to the chase.
Well, it's okay. I mean, now that we said you spied for the FBI, I mean, you can say whatever you want.
Okay. Anyway, so here was the problem. The FBI had to fund our sting operation. DOD didn't have the money for doing that. So the FBI gave us $300,000 to put this sting operation together to go after people who were selling defective aircraft parts to the military. So part of the consideration to get the money was we had to have an FBI agent on our team, which we didn't want to have. But however, they were going to be there, and they were going to keep an eye on the money. That was the idea. So we set up this little office, and we put cameras in there and tape recording equipment, and we invited, dealers, parts dealers and stuff to come in there. We taped them and got them on tape saying, well, we'll give you whatever kind of certifications for the parts you want. Ultimately, we bagged 19 companies.
Holy cow.
We have this FBI agent with us, and I'm not going to mention any names. He's probably retired by now, but still. So the DCIS agent and I wired ourselves up, and little tape recorders and a little microphone coming out of our watch band. And we went down to Southern California, and we went into a company in Van Nuys. And we're in there, and we introduced ourselves. We had phony business cards, and we introduced ourselves as part of this group called All Pacific Services, and how we had inside track, for example, in Honolulu with the Air Force and the Navy to supply, parts to them. And, did you want to do some business with us? So we're sitting in the owner's office, and the FBI guy is sitting with us, and he has this little vinyl briefcase, and he keeps lifting the briefcase up and thrusting it forward because he's got his little tape machine inside the briefcase.
It's all about the quality of recording.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I have to go back and give you the prequel to this. So we go down to Burbank Airport from Oakland, and we rent a car at Hertz. And we rent a car, it was a Seville, Cadillac Seville, so that we would look like we were, really affluent parts dealers. So we rent a black Cadillac Seville, drive over to this place, and the guy from the FBI, he's sitting in the back seat, and he's about 5'6". And the agent, DCIS agent, and I are sitting in the front seat, and we're just chatting about our approach to the owner of this company before we go in there. So I'm in the passenger seat, and we're parked across the street, and the next thing I see is the FBI agent get out of the car, stand right there by the back door in full view of everybody, and with a 35-millimeter camera, and he's taking pictures of the business across the street. So I asked the agent, is he supposed to be doing that? And he turned around, and I won't say what he said because we're on air, throws open his door, grabs the guy, and he throws him across the back seat. Now, the business across the street has this big roll-up door at the sidewalk. And right inside the door are a bunch of guys that are packaging parts. So they are now trying to figure out why somebody across the street's taking their picture. So the inspector general agent, we'll call him Mike. Anyway, so Mike throws the other guy across the back seat, slams the door, gets in the car, starts the car, drives up about two blocks, throws it into park, reaches around, grabs the FBI agent by his shirt, pulls him up between our two seats in the front, and starts screaming at him, "If you ever do something like that again, I'm going to break both your legs. Why were you doing that?" And this FBI guy says, "Well," he says, "we always want to take pictures of the target company for the file."
Wow.
Yeah, okay. So what happened was we drove back to Burbank Airport. This was 10 o'clock in the morning. We go back to Burbank Airport. We go back to Hertz. We swapped the black car for a white car. Okay? We called the owner, said, you know, our flight was delayed, and we can't be there till 1 o'clock. So everything is fine. Now we come about 10 minutes to 1 back to the company. We don't park across the street. We park right in front of the business with the white car now, and we go inside. Now we're sitting there in the owner's office, and the FBI guy decides he needs to go to the bathroom. So the owner of the company says, "All right, go out of the office here, turn left, and it's the second door down the hall." So he gets up, and he goes down the hall. So we're sitting there with the owner of the company for about 15 minutes talking, and finally the owner, you know, says, "Gee whiz," he says, "you know, your friend's been in there for an awful long time. I hope he's okay." So Mike looks at me, and he says, "Go check on him." So I got up and I walked out there and I knock on the door to the bathroom and I said, "Hey, you okay in there?" He said, "Who is this?" I said, "It's Peter."
"Dave's not here, man."
Yeah.
Totally.
So he opens the door a little bit, okay, about 3 or 4 inches. And I said, "You okay in there?" He says, "I need a coat hanger." I said, "What are you, constipated or something?" "No." He says, "I dropped my gun in the toilet."
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my God. You can't even make this up.
You couldn't. You absolutely can't. He says, "I dropped my gun in the toilet." He says, "I need to get a wire coat hanger so I can bend it, so I can grab it. It's stuck in the bottom of the toilet, okay, in the trap. So I can pull it out of there."
Geez, what was he carrying, a pea shooter?
Wait a minute.
Wait for it.
Don't get ahead of it. So I go back to the owner's office, and the owner says, "Hey, is he okay?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "But he needs a coat hanger." And so Mike turns around, of course, and he says, "Well, is he constipated?" And I said, "No.
Tried that one.
He dropped his wedding ring in the toilet."
Oh, good call.
"And he's got to figure it out." Okay, so he gives me the coat hanger. I go back, knock on the door, opens the door a little bit. I get in the coat hanger, and I'm hanging on to the hanger. And he's trying to take it from me. He says, "Give me the hanger." I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "If you're going to start fishing that gun out of the toilet," I said, "then make sure when you hook it, you don't hook it on the trigger and shoot the toilet." Okay, so you asked the question, what was he carrying? He was carrying a Smith & Wesson Model 36 5-Shot Chief Special. Okay, so a few minutes later, he fished it out. He comes back, and he put it into his sport coat pocket instead of back in his leather pancake holster. You know, he didn't want to get the holster wet.
So he has this perfect water outline.
Absolutely.
Of a firearm. Oh, my God.
He comes walking in, and here he's printing. The gun is printing in his right-hand pocket of his cotton sport coat.
Yeah.
So about that point, I saw that. I jumped up, and I moved over to him, put my arm around him, and I said, "Okay, great. Glad to see you found the ring and everything." Butting up against him so that the owner of the business couldn't see the printing of the revolver. And I said, "You know, We got a plane to catch. Sounds to me like we have everything we need, and we'll get back to you. So the three of us go out, and we get into the car. Mike starts the car. He pulls the car two blocks down the street, throws it in the park, reaches around, grabs the guy in the back seat, and yanks him up between the two seats in the front again. He says, "What the hell were you thinking?" He says, "Why in the world are you carrying a firearm?" Well, because at the FBI, he says, when we're on a case, we're always supposed to be armed. And I'm going, this is white collar. This is, you know, nothing. Well, we got to shoot the pictures, and I'm supposed to be armed. So Mike tells him, you know, "If you ever do that again, I will take it from you, and I will shoot you in both kneecaps with it."
I'm surprised he didn't shoot the toilet. That really...
Oh, my God. Oh, that, I was afraid. I was listening for the noise.
Good call, though. I would have never thought of that.
That's my first thought, was he hooks the trigger and then shoots through the toilet.
Yeah.
Kills the toilet.
Yeah.
So that's one of the stories. We had to deal with this guy for 2 years.
Oh.
Was he a rookie guy, or had he been on the force for a while?
Yeah, was he supposed to be an experienced guy, or was he new?
Oh, no, he was an experienced guy.
Oh, bummer.
I mean, he had been with the Bureau for, you know, 15 years, I think.
Wow.
CPA. Okay, you've got to be either an attorney or a CPA to be picked up by the Bureau. So if you have a CPA that is trying to do, you know, white collar, whatever, it has no clue. Had absolutely no clue, and we spent 2 years trying to explain the fraud to him, and he just couldn't figure it out. Well, did the parts work? That's not the point.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So
this is like the Pink Panther.
It's Clouseau.
Yeah. It's Clouseau.
Absolutely Clouseau.
Great story.
Oh my God! Wow, that just makes you want to pull your eyelashes out.
Unbelievable.
All right. So need to take a quick break here. Okay. Let's take a quick break and we'll fast forward when we come right back. Our guest is Peter Friedman. We usually talk to him about Islam. We're going to talk about refugees in the second hour, but this hour, chatting about some FBI stuff. We'll be right back.
Somebody's always watching.
Maybe the private eyes are, but the FBI's not. They're fishing their guns out of the toilet.
Maybe they need to subcontract out the FBI, get some local yokels on the job, and get some crime solved.
Well, we had a big heist out at the airport here not so long ago, within the last year or so.
Reading International Airport?
Yeah, where the baggage claim, or the little baggage turnaround is like 9 feet long.
Yeah.
But the FBI couldn't be bothered to look into it, or wouldn't look into it, or anyways, very frustrating.
Oh, got a better one for you.
Oh, good.
Okay, so fast forward, summer 2000. I'm working as a VP of quality over at Oakland Airport, and there's a flight school next to us. Now, I think you saw from my CV, I just got the 50-year award from the FAA for living long enough in aviation to get it.
Yeah, Master Mechanic Award, 50-year.
There you go. So I'm also a flight instructor. I've got 3,000 hours. I've flown everything up to and including a G4 Gulfstream 4. All right, so the summer of 2000, I'm at Oakland Airport. And there's a guy on our line service, okay, that moves airplanes around and fuels them and stuff like that. And the guy's name is Muhammad. So immediately, you know, I'm interested. So I go out on the ramp, and I talk to Muhammad, nice kid. Turns out he's taking flying lessons at the flight school next door. So I asked him who his instructor was, because I was on the curriculum advisory board for the school. So he tells me who the instructor is. So I go and I talk to the instructor, ask him how this guy is doing. He says, well, this is a really strange guy. He says, he's really not so interested
in landing,
in landing the plane.
No! Oh.
And it's like, what?
Yeah.
He says, yeah. He says, he's got about 20 hours. He says, and I've been working with him, and he has more fun, okay, flying around in the air and manipulating the controls and everything and doing turns and climbing and descending and stuff. But landing really makes him nervous, and he's not interested in that. He's just interested in being in the air and flying around. So I call the FBI office in San Francisco. Now, these are the same guys that I already knew from years before. And I said, you know me, all right? And you really ought to come over here and let me tell you what's going on here. So a couple days later, I get two newbies. One is a guy who's been with the Bureau for maybe less than a year, and he brings the girl along with him, brand new agent. She's been an agent now for 2 months. And I'm trying to explain the situation to him, and they don't understand. Well, maybe he just needs to have additional instruction, you know, and I'm going, look, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, all right, and I really think you ought to do a background on this kid because there's something here that's not right. So we fast forward to 9/11 now, the following year, and it turns out that this kid was one of these support people for the 19 hijackers.
Wow.
Holy cow.
So after that occurs, the end of the week after 9/11, the end of that week, I went on the FAA's website. Now, this is very interesting. If you go to FAA.gov, and on the right-hand side, you can... On the menu bar, it will say Airman Certification. So if you click on that, and then it has a little drop-down menu, and it says Search Airman. And you click on that. Now, you get a page with a bunch of fields in it to do a search. So what I did was I put in first the word Muhammad. And I got about 20 pages where the FAA had issued pilot's licenses and mechanic's licenses to people named Muhammad. Then I put in Rashid, and then I put in Ahmed. I wound up with about 70 pages of people that had taken either mechanic instruction, flight instruction here, had foreign addresses. I punched them, put it in a three-ring binder, and I called these monkeys over across the bay again, and I said, you know, I have something here for you. I don't know whether you are aware that you can do this. So these guys came back over, and I gave them the binder, and they said, oh, my God, this is great. Where did you get this?
No.
I said, I got it on the FAA's website. Oh, wow. Well, we had no idea that was available. Okay.
Okay.
So all of our paranoia is unfounded.
Yes. Never heard from them again. Never heard from him again.
No kidding.
Yep.
That's fairly scary. And here, you know, there's, I don't know. The FAA here, I'm going to say locally, it's the northern part of the state. There's a little airport up there just outside of Tule Lake. And it's part of it's on the site of an old internment camp, one of the Japanese internment camps. And
yep.
So anyway, the internment camp has a, you know, 37-acre site for a, you know, tell the story monument type of thing, which is
right,
larger than Pearl Harbor, we should point out. But they have decided that they want the airport. I mean, they want the airport taken out. And here's the FAA supposed to be helping the people that are running the airport, the city and the county, put some fencing around it, because all it is old split rail fence. It's all down around the airport. The deers run out on the runway and stuff like that.
Yep.
FAA is actually helping to tangle it up with the Japanese and make it harder for the airport folks to put in a fence. They've been no help whatsoever.
Yep, and they'll use airway trust fund money to do it too, which is our tax money.
Yeah, it's been crazy. Who would think? I mean, their job is aviation, and they've said right straight along, well, we have no interest in taking the airport out because it's in a strategic location. Besides the fact that all of the crops there on the Klamath project, so you've got $600+ million of agriculture that's all sprayed from that airport. It's one of the largest employers in the area in that area. It's not that many people, but it's a large employer, and they're doing nothing to help these guys secure their airport and fight back the encroachment of this group. It's crazy.
So as far as the FBI goes, is I would assume, which gets me in trouble every time, that they have to go through regular training updates and field training and such. Is that the case? I mean, it's really hard for me to wrap my mind around the fact that here we have the FBI, which is supposed to be the premier law enforcement agency in the country, just getting all this bad press. And from what I'm hearing, a lot of it is justified. And it's been going on now, it sounds like, for a long time, and people just haven't been really aware of it. Is that the case?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. You remember ever since J. Edgar Hoover passed away, but you remember the O.J. Simpson trial back in 94?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they proved down there in court legitimately that the FBI laboratory had made a number of mistakes in identifying blood spatter and all kinds of stuff. And that was one of the ways that, unfortunately, the jury decided to let O.J. go.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes all the way back to the laboratory, and it just, again, you know, FBI, famous but incompetent.
Yeah, it just doesn't give you very much confidence or faith in the system when you have the FBI, the DOJ, at the top of the ladder, administering justice for folks like you and me. We get into this system for whatever reason. I kind of feel like I'm a tiny fish in a big pond. There, I'm going to get mowed over by incompetence, and there's not a whole lot I can do about it.
Pretty much. I would say that's probably accurate. You know, the FBI agents really are you know, government trained, just the way the deputies were down in Parkland who didn't run into the school.
Right.
Coward County?
Yeah.
Not good.
You don't hide behind your patrol car. I was a deputy for 5 years, and I can tell you right now, I was a pilot for San Bernardino County. And we were doing all kinds of drug interdiction and everything. And, you know, I mean, that's you either accept the job or you don't. And if you're not going to do the job, then find something else to do because you're putting lives at risk.
Yeah, and you know, and in fairness to the deputies, you can train for that type of scenario all day long, but until it happens, you're not sure how you're going to react. But when it happens, you got to pull it together and make it happen is right. And that wasn't the case, doesn't sound like.
Well, that's supposedly what we learned from Columbine. Because in Columbine, what they did, since that hadn't happened before, they set up the usual perimeter, waited for the SWAT team to show up, you know, and right after that, they changed the entire paradigm for an active shooter. I do a lot of active shooter programs for businesses and, families and private individuals and stuff. And what really bothered me about the thing in Florida was we're teaching these kids to, you know, run and hide rather than be able to assess the situation and then take some proactive position as opposing to just, you know, waiting and trying to hide and be quiet and hoping that the alligator will eat them last.
Right, right. And that is a situation that, you know, I wouldn't wish on anybody. You don't know how you're going to react in the face of somebody mowing everybody down with a gun, and you don't have a gun. But that, again, is another issue that we need to fix in these schools. There has to be, well, they had armed security at this school.
Yeah,
but,
I was going to say, the security thing.
Yeah, the whole, you know, their argument is, well, we don't want our kids to feel like, you know, they're in an armed or a security state or whatever. But, you know, we have them in banks. We have them in airports.
We have to take a really quick break before we wind up on that. And then we can hit that because you have been a firearms instructor for over 50 years. So I think you're probably qualified to speak to that topic. Our guest, Peter Friedman, you are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
That's what we need at the school.
Well, I think the FBI is trained in mind reading.
Yeah, they are.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, dealing with fools. That's the part Peter learned about.
They look you right in the eye and laser beam you, and you're all
done.
That's it. You can't lie.
It's over.
Yeah.
True story. So, okay, after 50 years of firearms instruction, what's your thought for the school situation?
Well, watching all this stuff now for almost 2 weeks, it just fascinates me over and over and over again. That, you know, we protect banks, we protect airports, we protect
exactly
everything, you know, with firearms. We do not protect our schools. And especially here in California, it's just unbelievable. I've got three grandkids. They go to school up here in the Bay Area. And every time I'm over at their school, there's two different schools and they're wide open. They're not fenced off. They're absolutely wide open. Anybody can come in there. There's a sign saying, please check in at the office.
Or not.
Well, plus they're gun-free zones, and they you know, post that so everybody can see it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was going to put a sign on my front lawn because I've got a liberal neighbor. And I was going to put a sign on my front lawn with a big arrow saying, he has no guns.
Somebody did make one of those signs. It was something about,
it was,
you know,
a big sign. I saw that.
Yeah, remember
like
that?
4x8 sign.
Yeah, my neighbor has no guns. Rob his house.
Yep. Go there first.
It just, people don't understand, you know. A fat person is going to blame the spoon for them gaining weight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put the spoon down.
Well, it is crazy that We don't have somebody armed in all of our schools. You know, and in the past, I don't think it was really necessary. Nobody even thought about going in and doing this. But now that it's become this thing.
And you get so much notoriety.
And you get all this notoriety. Yeah. I mean, we've got to change that because they are a target now.
Well, we also got to find out what kind of drugs this kid was on.
Yeah.
We know that in Columbine, Dylan and the other guy were on these psychotropic drugs. You know, I mean, that's just something that has occurred now within the last two generations. You know, what has changed? All right, we didn't have this before. Why are we having this now? And then you discover that the schools recommend Ritalin and Adderall and stuff like that on kids that are actually, for the most part, very bright. And they get bored in school because they're teaching to the lowest common denominator.
Right.
And so you've got to keep these other kids, you know, occupied and interested. You know, otherwise that exacerbates the problem. Now, I'm not a crazy gun nut person. As far as I'm concerned, being an NRA training counselor and law enforcement firearms instructor and everything, when people go to buy a firearm, I would recommend strongly that they have at least 4 hours of actual on the range training with a certified instructor. So that's one of the things that I've been pushing forever, because I work with several gun stores here in the Bay Area as an instructor, and I'm fascinated by the fact that, you know, a husband will bring their wife in, a boyfriend brings the girlfriend in, and they get them a little, you know, five-shot Smith revolver or something like that, with no training whatsoever. And then, you know, most of the time, it's an accidental thing that will occur. But, you know, training is a big part of it. Now, if you get a person, and, you know, this reminds me of Chris Kyle, okay? If you go back to the movie and what happened to him, if you remember, and he was the American
yeah.
Sniper, the
right.
movie, and... You know, he decided to get out of Iraq and whatever and come back here, and he was going to work with vets. And it was a vet who had very serious PTSD who killed him. I mean, just, you know. But as an instructor, I have seen people come through who, yes, have legally been able to have a firearm, but then I have turned them down for instruction. And I have told people with them, this person really should not have a firearm, you know, because they are not looking at it as another power tool, which is what it is. It's a power tool like a bandsaw or an electric drill that requires that same amount of training, if you will, and it doesn't suffer negligence very well. And so when I train people, I start out by asking them, hey, you know, do you use a drill at home? Yeah, well, would you drill a hole through something holding the something in your left hand while you're running the drill through with your right hand? No, I would never do that. Why? Because I would drill a hole through my hand. Hello? Yes, okay, now you have a firearm. And you take a look at the pointy end, and you're going to have a projectile coming out of that thing under 30,000 pounds of pressure. When a 9mm ignites in the chamber, it generates 30,000 pounds of pressure. So I always ask them, you know, what kind of a car did you come here today in? And it's, you know, a Toyota or it's a Chevy or whatever. I said, so you got a 3,000-pound car. And when you press the trigger on that gun, you are generating 10 times the weight of the car that you drove here in. And you ought to see the size of their eyes at that
yeah.
point. I have no idea.
I was going to say, that's a really
yeah.
good visual.
That's not even going to slow down when it contacts your
well,
body.
Well, concealed weapons are fairly difficult to get in your county, aren't they? I mean, our county is pretty, you know, our sheriff doesn't require you to, you know.
Yeah, you're in a Chalicue County. I'm in a May issue county. So here we have an excellent sheriff, David Livingston, and he wants to know who, you know, is requesting a concealed carry permit, and goes through a you know, a whole background check and everything.
We do all that. We have to do an interview there at the sheriff's office and all that kind of
right.
stuff.
Right. And I think that's a good thing.
But because it's my Second Amendment right is a good enough reason to apply, and it isn't in your county.
No, if you come in there and you fill out the DOJ form, and in Section 7, what is your reason, and you put down it's my Second Amendment right, they're going to reject it right now.
Yeah, that's pretty
good. Period. You know, just, it's a judgment call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why do you think you need this? And we have a very, very good lieutenant here who knows how to interview people and kind of dig down. And, you know, there are questions about the family situation, background, military, you know, and because the sheriff's putting his signature on that thing.
Sure.
You know, and he doesn't need, pardon the pun, the blowback.
Right. No. Not a lot of people with concealed carry permits are out there committing crimes or killing people. I don't know if there have ever even been any.
No. If you go to the FBI's website, and again, FBI.gov, and you go into their statistics section in there, there is not one single record on file of anybody who has had a concealed carry permit committing a crime.
Not surprising.
Nothing. Absolutely. Well, you've got to be more responsible.
Well, you do. You have to be totally responsible as to who you're, you know, administering these permits to. But you go into an area like the Bay Area in California, you know, San Francisco, Walnut Creek, San Jose. You are not going to get a concealed carry permit. Period. I don't care if you're a bank teller or transporting money in the middle of the night, they won't give you one, and I disagree with that.
And yet 100% of your criminals have them.
Yeah. Yeah, so it really does depend on your sheriff. It absolutely depends on your sheriff, but...
What do you say? We only have like a minute left, but I've always recommended that people go through the concealed weapons training, just because it's really good training. Whether or not you want the permit, if you own a firearm, that's a really good way to get some training.
Well, I do that, as a matter of fact, for the department in this county. You are right. And I do stuff through the NRA, of course, as a training counselor. We have a program called Personal Protection Outside the Home. And that's specifically a course for CCW holders. But it's a good course, you know, like you said, either way. There's the prerequisite course to that, by the way, is personal protection inside the home, which is really good because then it tells everybody the laws and everything else involved.
Right. And you've got to know that if you're going to carry a weapon, you've got to know when
Absolutely.
And where and how. And
alrighty, we will be right back with our guest Peter Friedman. We will be talking about the refugee crisis in the next hour. So you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And you can find all sorts of good information about the program, contact information for us, too. If you have ideas for programs or you want to sound off about anything, it's wethepeopleradio.us. And when you go there, it's got our phone numbers and email addresses and everything. We like to hide right out in the open. You have archives dating back to 2010. Lots of good information there. We've done a bunch of shows about veterans. I need to create a new tab about Islam and refugees because we've done so many different shows with so many different guests and probably a tab on national security. But for the time being, you can fan through the archives and pick those out if those are topics that you like. And the sponsor for this hour,
Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota dealer. Contact them now for their service special.
Because the grass is growing now.
The grass is growing. You know, it's only February, and we're supposed to be having, well, of course, we are having a little bit of cold weather, but the sun's out. We haven't had any rain for, gosh, a month or better. And that grass is growing like a foot a day.
dog got a tick the other day.
Yeah, I know the ticks are out, too.
Dog never gets ticks in February.
Yeah, so call Team Power if you want some work done on your tractor or you want a great deal on a Kubota or John Deere tractor. They'll fix you up and give you some expertise on what's the best buy and what's the best tractor for your need. So give them a call, 226-9226. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard out there next to Phil's Propeller. Give them a call.
Right there off I-5.
Right.
Super
off.
Simple.
Very
Monday through
simple.
Friday,
Monday
8
through
to
Friday,
5.
8 to 5, yeah.
Any other good stuff we're forgetting? Parts? Service?
Parts, service.
Sales?
They do it all. Yeah.
It's incredible. They're
your one-stop shop right there.
If you go there and look around, you might see Bill.
Yeah, you might.
So you could just go up there to heckle him, actually.
Yeah, I'm
just
good
add that to the little commercial.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, we can.
There's a heckling opportunity.
Yeah, we can deal with hecklers. That's okay.
Yeah, if you have any complaints, just go up to Team Power and complain to Bill.
Yeah, there you are.
Our guest last hour was Peter Friedman, and he's sticking with us for the second hour because we're going to shift gears a tiny bit to refugee resettlement. He is an all-around smart guy on lots of different topics. 50-year award from the FAA for the Master Mechanic Award. Got that in 2016. Been a firearms instructor for over 50 years. Done more stuff than, I mean, you're like the Army. How did that commercial used to go? You know, you've done more stuff by, they've done more stuff by breakfast than we do all day.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
right.
Yeah,
be all you can be.
Yeah, there you go. So how about this? For our guests that haven't heard you before, what, I mean, obviously 50 years in the FAA flight industry and flying all sorts of different kinds of planes and did a little stint there with some dopes at the FBI trying to help them catch criminals, which was harder than it sounded to work with the FBI, not catch the criminals. All these different things. So what led you into the study of Islam?
Well, many, many years ago, and we're going to go back to when I was 9, which would have been 1953, I guess, 53, 54, somewhere in there.
Man, you're old.
what can I say?
Said Bill.
My dad.
Said the old guy sitting next to me.
There you go. Well, old age and treachery will always overcome youth and skill.
Exactly.
Absolutely. When you cross that threshold, you know it.
I'm counting on it.
Oh, I'm telling you. So, no, way back when, my father was one of the founders in 1938 of the Jewish temple in Beverly Hills called Temple Emmanuel. And he was the executive director there for 22 years. And every time I used to tell people that, you know, and they would say, oh, is he a rabbi? I would say, no, he's honest.
Nice.
Which we can talk about on another program. Anyway, so I grew up there, and I used to go on the weekends. You know, we had Saturday school, Sunday school, whatever. And my father would take me down there with him while he checked on everything. And I would sit in the library at the temple, and I would read. And discovered a number of things during that period of time. I love Napoleon, and we can do a whole program on that because I lecture on Napoleon all the time. And I discovered that there are two groups of people that I really was fearful of and didn't like. The first, of course, were Nazis, because we had a number of people who were members of the temple who had been in Auschwitz and other concentration camps. And the other ones I didn't like were the Muslims, because in reading the books that I read, I discovered that the Muslims, for some unknown reason, were always on the side of the Germans. And they were on the side of the Germans in 1870 in the Franco-Prussian War, World War I, World War II especially, and the uncle of Yasser Arafat, who was Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, met with Hitler in 1941. You can look at Google and you'll see the pictures of Hitler and Amin al-Husseini sitting together. He's got his white turban on. But al-Husseini donated several regiments of Bosnian Muslims to the SS, who were then used in Poland and Czechoslovakia to slaughter Jews. So, you know, I kind of had a bad taste at that point, and I decided I wanted to find out what actually made people, human beings who were theoretically educated. And at that time, the German society was one of the most educated in the history of the world. They produced guys like Einstein and others. And so I started researching. And once I put all this research together, I started to talk to people about this. And studying the Quran, studying the origin of the Quran, which is really interesting. We can do a show on that if you'd like. Because all of the crescent symbols and the sun symbols and everything else that you find on mosques, well, they go way back to Egypt, and they go back to the time of Ramses. So, you know, if you look at all of this stuff with a critical eye and get away from the ideology, you know, there's reality and then there's the faith part. And faith is what you can't empirically prove. You've just got to take it on faith. So when you start to dissect this and you find all of these other things that become involved in how they were usurped by the followers of Muhammad, all right, and I referred to that last week as the Mohammedans, who were the followers of Muhammad, you discover where all of this stuff in the Quran actually came from. Now, it's interesting, in Arabic, it's referred to as Al-Quran, Al meaning the, and Quran meaning telling, because it was not written down at that time, of the time of Muhammad. This was all a transmitted to everybody back and forth verbally. So Al-Quran in Arabic means the telling. So now you take a look at some of this stuff, and you start to read these 114 chapters, 6,247 verses, and you can't read it. You can't sit down and read it, because they are answers to questions for the most part in these chapters in the Quran, and you don't have the question. All you have is the answer. And it's like the old Johnny Carson show. If you remember Johnny Carson, when he pretended to be Karnak.
Karnak, yeah.
And he would hold the card up to his turban, and he would give you the answer, okay? And he would say, the answer is 4. And then he would open up the envelope, and he would read the question. Well, the problem is that in the Quran, 90% or better of everything written in the Quran are answers to questions that were posed theoretically by Muhammad to the angel Gabriel in the cave over 23 years, and the revelations are the answers that came from Allah through Gabriel answering these questions. So when you read this, it's totally disjointed. It's not in chronological order. The shortest chapter is the very first one, which contains what's called the Shahada. And it's only a few sentences long. That's chapter one. That's the pillar of faith of Islam. The second chapter, chapter two, is the longest chapter in the entire book. And they gradually get shorter and shorter and shorter until you get to the 114th chapter, which once again is very short.
All right. Hold that thought, Peter. We'll come right back. We're actually taking our breaks on time today. It's a whole new idea. If it feels funny, that's because it's just a new idea. We'll be right back with our guest, Peter Friedman. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
We got too many gangsters doing dirty deeds. Too much corruption and crime in the streets. It's time the long arm of the law put a few more in the ground. Send them all to their maker and he'll settle them down. You can bet he'll settle down. Cause justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line. When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune. And we'll all meet back at the local saloon. And we'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, saying, whiskey for my man.
whiskey for my men, beer for my horses. Oh no, I've said too much. I set it up. That's me in the corner.
All right, Peter, where do you want to go? The last thing you said was the final chapter was super short. Why did that happen anyway? They just lose enthusiasm?
No, it's just the first 93 chapters were written in Mecca. And what happened was Muhammad initially, and this is all in Frank Burley's book, by the way. It's all about Muhammad.
I recommend that.
Best book ever.
Yeah, you'd have to read the actual documented life story of Muhammad. And, you know, he grew up with the Jewish tribe, the Quraysh, that was living in Mecca at the time. There was a Christian group that was there. And then you had the pagan Arabs. And he grew up, you know, in the midst of all of these people. He pretty much grew up all by himself. You know, his mother was gone, his father was gone. And he was influenced by these various groups, and he was somewhat drawn to the Jewish tribe in the Old Testament, and decided that, you know, he, and this is only my opinion, of course, based on my research, that he could probably convince the Jews that he was the third and last prophet after Moses and Jesus, and started to come up with these revelations, and again, you'd have to read Frank's book, because he just has done a magnificent job, and he wrote these 93 revelations that he supposedly had received out sitting in the cave, you know, from the angel Gabriel sent to him by Allah, and he went to the Jews, and he was constantly hammering them, saying, look, you know, this is what God is telling me, and you have to believe me and accept me and everything. And finally, they decided, you know, in their best Monty Python way, got a very nice one, and we don't need you. You know, if you remember Monty Python
yes.
and the Holy Grail.
You know, we need to play more of that.
He really irritated them to the point where they chased him out of town, and he and his 12 followers decided to go about 200 miles north to Medina, and that's where the balance of the chapters were written, which are all of the war and violent chapters.
But weren't the original writings that he came up with kind of centered around Judaism?
That's correct. And if you read the Quran, he talks a lot about Moses and Abraham trying to weave this story together to lead to the conclusion that the Jewish tribe in Mecca should accept him
right.
as the prophet. And then they chase him out of town, and obviously sour grapes set in there, and I'm going to show them. And so he goes to Medina, and if you go to Book 2, verse 106, that's called the abrogation verse, because all of the original Meccan verses were passive. They defined the faith. And then when he went to Medina, he had to find a way to abrogate the passive verses that he had already come up with, and replace them with the other ones. So when you go to Book 2, verse 106, it says that, you know, Allah will abrogate certain verses and give you better ones. And so that's what happened up in Medina. So now he gets a bunch of these people together in Medina, and what happened was he appealed to the pagan Arabs, and if you see on your website, you put up the IQ thing,
yep.
the research
right.
on the Middle East IQ. Well, so he gets hold of the pagan Arabs, and he has them look at the spice and silk caravans that are proceeding unprotected across the northern peninsula of Saudi Arabia at the time. And he basically goes to them and says, hey, look, you know, if you'll believe in my God, you can steal and rape and kill and do whatever you want to with these caravans, and you can keep 80%, but 20% is reserved for Allah, and since I'm his messenger, you just give me the 20%. And from a historical perspective, if you go back that far, that's what occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so gradually they started to accumulate wealth by attacking these caravans. And as they accumulated wealth, they bought horses, they bought armaments, and created an army, and the rest is history, until they were stopped. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, where all of this stuff came from. Now, where did the Quran come from? The actual written Quran was not put together and collated until the third successor to Muhammad, because it went through Ali. Ali was married to Fatima, who was Muhammad's daughter. And Ali, of course, was assassinated. This is where the Shiites separate from the Sunnis, because the Shiites believe that the descendants of Ali should be the rightful successor in Islam. And from Ali, it went to Uthman. And then Uthman didn't fare very well either for several years. And then after he was gone, you come to Umar. And Umar is the guy who got all of the followers of Muhammad together at that point, because they were now old. They had been involved in all of these battles. They were getting killed off. And Umar convened a conference, if you will, in modern terms. And he said, okay, he says, any of you guys, he says, you know, who were with Muhammad when questions were asked and the answers were given, you need to write those down. So that they got something like 60,000 index cards turned into headquarters. And Umar had to put a group together to go through all of these things. And this is where the hadith comes from of Bukhari. You know, what is truth and what is made up for, you know, somebody's ego and stuff like that. Well, they threw out a whole bunch of this stuff from various people who had, you know, sent their index cards in. And they then took all this information, they wrote it down, and that is where the Quran came from.
Which is why it doesn't read like a story.
Exactly.
Frank's book is great, and so for people who might be driving or not have a pen in their hand, we have linked that on our site underneath the title We Recommend. It's in the sidebar of all of our stuff. We did a couple shows with Frank about that book. Really a good read. And, you know, you would think it would be kind of boring because it's a biography, but it isn't. It's
compelling.
Very much like
a spy
thriller.
You won't put it down because it does read like a story, and it moves pretty quickly.
And it makes sense of a lot of stuff. All of a sudden,
really
you see these things come into focus.
It all together. Uh-huh.
So shift that to
let's talk about refugees.
To the refugee thing, yeah, because I'm looking at some of these reports that you have sent us that I've linked on the page.
Let's walk through it and start at the beginning. So
all right.
If you pull up the 2017 proposed refugee admissions, fiscal year 2017. Now, the government's fiscal year starts October 1st. And ends the following year on September 30. So this is basically the fiscal year 2016-2017. So if you look at the title page, by the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act, or Nationality Act, that was ran through Congress by LBJ, Joe Biden, and I wish somebody would bring this up to old Joe, and Ted Kennedy. And I think I told you last week that they pushed this thing through for the simple reason that they wanted to have a way of bringing Vietnamese refugees back here and creating them as Democrats, ultimately. And now, you know, we're doing the same thing with the Syrian refugees and everything else. So this just keeps repeating itself. So you're looking at this report to the Congress. And this report has to be given to the Senate and House Judiciary Committees every year. And it says submitted on behalf of the President of the United States, and that would have been Barack at that time, in fulfillment of the requirements of the Immigration and Nationality Act. Now, who contributes to this document? Department of State, and this is one of the reasons why Nunes is now going after the State Department, and hopefully Rex Tillerson's doing a good job there cleaning that swamp out. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and then the worst offender here is the Department of Health and Human Services. And hopefully our new director of that is trying to clean that out. So if you jump from that to page 5, there is a table on page 5, and it's stated refugee admissions program for fiscal 2017, proposed ceilings, table number 1. And it talks about refugee admissions in fiscal year 2015 and 2016 and the proposed refugee admissions by region for fiscal 2017. So the proposed 27, let's go down to 16 or 15 first. At the bottom of the page, you have roughly 70,000, the majority of which were coming from Africa and from the Near East and South Asia. And that kind of includes Burma, which is what, Myanmar now, I guess it is, and some of the Middle East countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, so that from that region, you wind up with close to 70,000 that they told the judiciary committees that the president was going to bring in fiscal 2015.
Now, that was predominantly Muslim. Correct?
That's correct. Well, there's a lot of other tables in there that will tell you precisely how many came in from which specific countries. It will tell you the ages, both male and female, the average nominal ages. And then when you get down to the end of the document, it talks about the 9 charities that are exclusive to the State Department for refugee resettlement. Nobody else can play the game.
Only
and the
those.
$1 billion a year that they get to resettle these refugees and the states and cities that are the preferred resettlement states and cities. California and Texas, of course, are number 1.
Yeah, and your town. We've got to take a really quick break and then we'll be right back. But I would encourage people who have the ability to go online while we're talking to you or while you're listening. WeThePeopleRadio.us and click on the page for today, February 25th, and check out some of the PDF files that he has there. It's a lot of really good information. We'll be right back with our guest, Peter Friedman.
There I was at the immigration scene, shining and feeling clean. Could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. Said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in. Let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and pray I can stay another day? Let me in. Immigration man, I won't toe your line today. I can't see it anyway.
There you go, Peter. That's the setup for what they're doing at the Immigration
Office. There you go.
Anyway, if you take a look at that page 5 on there for 2017, it also states that the president may specify circumstances under which individuals who are within their countries of nationality or last habitual residence may be considered a refugee for purposes of admission to the United States. So when Obama was in office, you can see how every year this kept escalating.
Oh, big time.
And, Oh, yeah. And then it says fiscal 2017 refugee admissions proposal recommends continuing such in-country processing for specified persons in Iraq, Cuba, Eurasia, the Baltics, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Can you say MS-13?
Right. So, but now, also, when you look at the numbers, when they give you the breakdown of the numbers on that chart, and that's pretty interesting, too.
Oh, yeah. But now cross over and go to 2018, and you will see what Trump has done. In 2018, Trump has taken this from 110,000 in the ceiling for 2017, and he has dropped that now down to 45,000. But in there, you still have 19,000 coming from mainly Muslim-controlled African countries. Cut that number almost in half from the last 7-8 years. And then you have 17,000 down from 35,000 from the mainly Middle East and Asian Muslim countries. So Trump has definitely cut that, you know, way down.
Yeah, he didn't exactly, you know, he didn't cut it off. And I think that's what the mainstream media would love to have you believe, is that he's just closed the door. There's still a fair amount coming in.
What does this look like historically, since you've looked at this a lot more than we have? Has it always been like this, or is this were these new, did this change?
No, if you do the research, you'll discover that this has been pretty much promulgated by the Democrat Party. It went way up in 65. Like I said, there was very little immigration, if any, between 1924 and 1964. And then Joe Biden and Ted Kennedy got together and came up with this novel idea of bringing all of these third world people in here, putting them on welfare, making them Democrats, and then ultimately nationalizing.
And they said that out loud. I mean, you're not just guessing that and putting it out there.
No, you have my PowerPoint presentation that you put up.
Right, it's well documented. I mean, just for people that are listening that aren't looking at the backup information you sent. I mean, that isn't stuff anybody's got to make up. They actually said that was the plan.
Well, Al Gore and Bill Clinton in 1996, for his reelection, they went out and they nationalized 330,000 people that came out of Somalia and other third world countries, and they nationalized them in order to have them vote in his reelection in 96. I mean, if you want to take the time to go through stuff, you will find all of this. But most people, you know, bitch and moan about it, but they're lazy. They're lazy. They don't do the legwork, you know, to find all of this stuff. And it's all there. And Congress knows about it, you know. The other thing that really scares me at this point is that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, up until about 3 or 4 months ago, was a guy named Luis Guterres. Well, Guterres, if that name is familiar to you, used to be the communist president of Portugal, who was involved with the International Communist Party, and now he happens to be the Secretary General of the UN.
Terrific.
And this is the guy who had to approve all of the refugees coming to the United States. And we set up these refugee camps over there in Syria, for example, in Jordan, and they were funded by the UN, and they're full of Muslims. People want to know, how come we're not bringing any Christians in, Christian refugees? Well, the problem is, the way the game got played, Guterres said that, okay, if you're going to get the UN recommendation to come to America, you have got to register in one of our UN-maintained refugee camps. Well, now imagine a Christian family attempting to go into a Muslim refugee camp in order to, you know, come in.
Yeah.
And the Muslims threw them out. They wouldn't let them come in. That's why there's no Christian refugees coming in. So there are local Christian groups who are resettling, persecuted Christians from the Middle East. But the whole UN thing, it's all driven by the OIC, or the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And they're totally in cahoots with them. So when you go further down towards the end, all of your tables, and I'm on, for example, I'm on page 56 of the 2018 report. And when you take a look at that, here's refugee arrivals by country of origin. And this is back now from fiscal year 2016, 2017. That was Obama. So you've got 2,700 from Afghanistan. You've got 5,800, and these are all Muslims, 5,800 from Bhutan. You have 12,000 from Burma. You've got 16,000 from the Republic of the Congo, Eritrea, Ethiopia. You have some from the former Soviet Union that are like the Chechens.
Iran and Iraq, big numbers.
Yeah, Iran and Iraq, 3,750 from Iran, almost 10,000 coming out of Iraq. Let's see, where's some more?
Oh, and then zoom down to the fun number, 9,000 out of Somalia.
There you go, 9,020 just out of Somalia. Thank you, Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, some of this stuff, here's Syria, 12,000 on page 58.
Yeah.
Yep.
Here's 1,458 from Sudan. Here's 12,587 from Syria. You know, and it keeps on going. And you look at these tables. Look at the next table on page 59, the median age and gender of the refugee arrivals. Look at the percentage of males, and look at the median age.
Yep, they're all fighting
okay?
age.
These are all refugees of military age. Syria, the median age is 20.
Yeah, 47% female, 52% male.
Exactly. Look at Burma, same thing. 52% are males, average age 22.
But they always talk about how it's women and children.
It's bull.
But that's just a lie.
Nonsense. And here is the documented proof.
Yep.
Here is the absolute documented proof. Here's select age categories, for example, page 60. And this is all public record. It's now on your website. Anybody can go and access it and just read this stuff. And then you go down further. Here, page 61, refugee arrivals by state. Okay, where are all of these going? 7,900 of them. California.
California.
I mean, just, hello?
Yeah,
Michigan,
that's the largest percentage in the entire country.
And then you go down to Texas. 7,800 went to Texas.
Well, 5,000 went into New York. I mean, there'll be some alarm bells there.
Well, you start looking at California's... you know, at the weight on the system, on the school system, on the welfare rolls, on all those things, and people, of course, say, "Well, they can't get welfare, but these people come here can't speak the language."
Well, Starbucks hired 10,000 of them, and Howard Schultz, he wants 10,000 more.
Wow!
I'm not surprised. Look at Kentucky, 2,400 from Kentucky, where they just built the huge mega mosque in Murfreesboro.
Oh.
So if you go back to 2001, for example, there were 900 mosques that were in the United States. Today there's over 3,500.
Wow.
You build them, they will come.
Exactly. In that order.
Well, those are mostly all moderate Muslims.
Yeah, that's right. They're just religion peace.
That's why they're here.
All righty, really quick break, and we'll be back with our guest, Peter Friedman, here listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I don't think that's what they were saying about. I don't know.
Use the music for our own purposes. So, Peter,
right, so
when you scroll down on this thing, because during the commercial we're scrolling down,
United, go to page 64.
Yeah, that's the one. Percentage of total resettled, United States 62%.
Of all the countries.
As opposed to Hungary, who took four people.
And we were catching all kinds of flack for not letting enough in. Remember that?
Yeah, we had 78,000 people as opposed to Hungary's four. But while we're talking about this, though, isn't the whole refugee idea they come here until their country stops doing whatever it is that's doing, which is probably killing them or other people or each other, and then they're supposed to go back, right? Isn't this a temporary deal?
It's supposed to be. However, let me tell you what the scam is.
Yeah, that's
we're
what
going
I was
back
to
making new Democrats. If you come in here as a legal refugee, just the way I have documented on the PowerPoint that you put up on your website, you come in here, you get a green card as a refugee, you get federal aid, all right? That goes on for about 6 months. They turn you over to the local counties now, and the feds go out and they find a bunch more to bring in here. They work through these nine charities. Who go through $1 billion with these charities. You would not believe how much money the people who run these charities make, $400,000 or $500,000 a year. And most of them are Catholic charities, which just blows my mind when you take a look at who the nine charities are. They designate specific states and cities where they're going to resettle these people. You know, and as soon as you have the green card as a legal refugee, that is your automatic pathway to citizenship. If you come here illegally, and this is part of the DACA thing and all the parents that brought them here, there is no path legally to citizenship. You have to create that path. But if you come here as under asylum, or you come here as a legal refugee under that Nationality Act, you are entitled to apply for citizenship. So now you take a look at the countries where these people are coming from. You look at the age of these people. You take a look at, the IQ report. And obviously, they're going to be Democrats.
Ouch.
No argument here.
You know, I mean, it's the old adage, when you rob Peter to pay Paul, you always get Paul's vote, and then you wind up with a sore Peter in the process.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but now, of course, we are tainted for life.
It's all here. It's all there, and all anybody has to do is just take a look at it. You know,
yeah,
the
PowerPoint has great information. That's well worth the time.
And you took Guterres, you know, and you put him as the fox in charge of the hen house. You know, now he's the Secretary General of the UN. So, you know, at some point, I mean, just thank God we elected Donald Trump. Can you imagine if we had elected Hillary Clinton?
No, it would have been like pouring gas on a fire.
Honest to God, all of this stuff coming out now would all have been swept under the carpet. They would have gotten away with it. The Bureau and DOJ would have continued doing what they were doing. And somehow I get up every morning and I thank the good Lord. I'll tell you, he was watching out this time.
Well,
enough is enough.
With all of this this refugee thing, talk about the charities that are involved in. Why are there only a handful? What did you say, nine of them?
Those are nine exclusive charities that are contracted with by the Department of State. Nobody else can get in there. It's been that way for years. And they are in charge of doing, you know, what you have to characterize as this charitable work in bringing these people in here. Our tax money goes to these people and this is the bad part, until about 6 months are up, and then these people are resettled and we have people resettled here in Contra Costa County, for example. 2 years ago, I was on the civil grand jury, and we looked into this, of course, and the county of Contra Costa has 1,200,000 residents in the entire county. I think we're the ninth largest county in the state.
Explain to your traffic.
We have a general welfare budget of almost $540 million. Now, when I go down to the regional medical center down in Martinez, and we went in there and took a whole tour by the grand jury, you would not believe how many robes and hijabs were in there getting free health care because Walnut Creek is one of the identified cities for resettlement, as is San Diego, Modesto, and Sacramento. And they're in there and they're grabbing resources. If you go to, for example, they have a refugee card that's given to them by the Department of State and Homeland Security. And I've got that on the PowerPoint.
I'm looking at it.
There's a sample of it. And if they walk into a pharmacy with a prescription, any pharmacy with a prescription, they get that medicine for free by just showing the refugee card.
Hmm. Wow.
What I noticed on the PowerPoint here, you have refugee furniture. What's the story there?
Okay, you know all these people trying to get from Tunisia across the Mediterranean to Greece and Italy?
In the boats,
And they get intercepted? Well, the Greek Navy intercepted a cargo ship. Theoretically, on the manifest, it said it was furniture for the refugee camp in Cyprus. And when the Greek Navy boarded the boat and they opened up the containers, that's what they found. Now, do you remember the movie Patton?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you remember the famous scene in there with Bill Mosher Montgomery and Ike's number two guy, General Beetle Smith, they're in the bathroom. And Montgomery blows, on the mirror and steams up the mirror, and he draws a picture of the island of Sicily. And he says the key to the invasion of southern Europe and Italy is going to be through Sicily. And then they make the funny comment, isn't it amazing that, the final invasion of Italy is taking place here in a latrine. And if you go back and you watch the movie again, where George Patton makes the comment that from the Mediterranean and from northern Africa, the Carthaginians, everybody came across from Libya and Tunisia and landed in Sicily and then went to Syracuse. And from there, they went into Italy. Well, it's only 400 miles from the boot of Italy to the Vatican. And if you recall, the head al-Baghdadi of ISIS made the comment that you at some point will see the black flag of ISIS fly over the Vatican.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And where are all these refugees coming from? They're all coming through Libya. Thank you, Hillary Clinton and Sid Blumenthal, for destroying, Gaddafi. And so all of these refugees and the rubber boats and everything, you don't see a whole lot of women in those boats.
No. No, they're all young men.
And they're all guys of military age.
Right.
And they get rescued by the Italian Navy and the Greek Navy. And I'm telling you, they're committing suicide by bringing these people into Sicily, into Cyprus, because they are going to begin to migrate as I have right there in the PowerPoint, showing how they are migrating right up there across the Mediterranean. It's only 150 miles, from Libya to Sicily.
Well, if the furniture seizures were actually arms, is that correct?
Oh, yeah, they were arms. They were arms that were headed for the refugee camp.
Right, right. Yeah, so that should tell you everything you need to know about what their intentions are.
Well, been their intentions for 1,400 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know why we were attacked on 9/11?
Tell me.
Because the last major defeat of the Muslim army was at the gates of Vienna on September 11, 1683. They hold a grudge. That was the last major defeat of the Muslim army.
A long grudge.
Yeah.
Hey,
well.
Tell us really quickly. We've got like a minute left. In your PowerPoint, you have a thing here. They get privacy rights with this refugee card. What exactly?
Oh, yeah.
What does that entail? Before we let you go here.
Well, if you were to go to Department of State or Homeland Security, and you ask them to please identify how many refugees, for example, that were relocated in Walnut Creek, California, they won't tell you. And they said, because of this act, we are not going to tell you where we have put these people.
Lovely.
So you go to Idaho, for example, and you go to Twin Falls, they have a lot of problems now because they are relocating a lot of the Syrian refugees in Twin Falls and Idaho. They're having a lot of problems, a lot of crime. I mean, you can look this up. Go to Google.
Big surprise.
Well, we're out of time.
Peter Friedman, as always, informative and ready to spring load for a bunch of other programs. So we will get hold of you to do that. Have an awesome weekend.
Far, we've been traveling far.